Well, good morning. My name is Zach Thompson. I'm a pastor here at Calvary Bible Church, but I'm usually at our Thornton campus. But it's always a joy to get to travel to our other campuses for a variety of reasons, one of which is it's so easy when we focus in on the place where God has us, which is good, we should be there, that we get a smaller picture of what God is doing than is actually what is happening. And so when I get to come to here, the Erie campus, it's full of stories of how God's been working in the last year, of how he's been working recently, and it's such a nourishment to me. It's the reminder that as we are one church in three locations, that as I come, I get to hear God working in new ways, but also similar ways. Though as we are going through the series that we've been in the summer, that, and when I say we, it's all of us. It's Boulder, Erie, and Thornton. We've been looking at the storyline of the Old Testament. And this was for a variety of reasons, one of which was so we can know it, so we can know what God did in the Old Testament to get a feel for the story. But also as we recognize that the way God worked then is going to be similar to how God works now. So as we look at how God works throughout the Old Testament history, as he continues his story into today, we can expect him to work in similar ways. And so with that, as we see people respond to him with faith in the Old Testament, that helps to give us encouragement, an example to live by faith as well. And so we reach now at a point of the story, and there's only a few more weeks of the series, but we're spending it around a really interesting time in Israel's history. This is coming off of God has been making promises and guiding his people all throughout this time. He says that he's going to set up a people for himself, this nation of Israel, but it's not just going to be for their own sake, but through them, all of the nations of the world would be blessed. That was a promise he made all the way back to Abraham. But while he's been pursuing his people, they've been turning away from him, following other gods or looking for life apart from him, like we saw during the period of the Judges. But now they're in this land where they can fulfill this mission God has given to them, a place that they can call home with security that's stable under the successful reigns of kings like David and Solomon. But all along this story, as we've been reading through the Old Testament, there's this similar cycle that seems to be taking place, this pattern that's repeated over and over again. Maybe you've been picking up on it if you've been with us in the series, that God is guiding his people, giving them everything that they have, but they turn away from God towards other gods. Then things go bad for them, so they cry out to God, God, where are you? As if they didn't just sprint out the door. But God shows up again, restores them, and things go well for a little bit until the cycle repeats itself over and over again. And maybe as we're getting into this new period of Israel's history, you are hopeful. Yes, let it be something else, something other than the story that seems to be going over and over and over again in the Old Testament. And if that's what you're hoping for, I do have good news for you. Assuming you're someone who likes bad news, because the cycle continues. That's exactly what happens during this period of Israel's history as well. They turn away from God, things fall apart, God rescues them, and it goes over and over again. As we look at where we are in the Old Testament storyline, we have this picture that helps us to see this is one story that God is working through it throughout. It's not a bunch of random grab bag incidents, but God is working consistently through the story. And we get to a place where we are now that just weeks after King Solomon dies, God's people, the nation of Israel, splits into two. And it's not a very subtle image on there. There's a big split that goes to show us where we are. You have the northern tribes, also called Israel or Samaria. And then you have the southern kingdom called Judah. So we have God's people here in the land that he promised to them, but it's not fully what the promise was. That God has given them this place, but it's more shaky than a home. God has put together a people for himself, but now his people are divided. God is continuing to be merciful, but God's people, rather than spending time with him, this place where he could be their God and they could be his people, they turn away towards others. And again, we see that cycle continue. But it's not as though this period where these kingdoms are divided came out of nowhere. As we said, we've been seeing this pattern for a while now, but they were also warned of this very thing before they even had a king. The prophet Samuel was giving a warning to the Israelites back in 1 Samuel chapter 12 to tell them exactly what would happen when they had kings. This is what he says in verse 14, 1 Samuel 12, 14. He says, "If you fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and do not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, if both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. Nothing will go wrong. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king. Before they even had a king, there was this warning that was given to them. If your kings will be faithful, then you will live in this land in perfect relationship with God forever. But if you have these faithless kings, if they rebel against God, then things will continue in this cycle. And the sad reality is, if you track through this period of the divided kingdom, you look at the kings in the north, in Samaria and in Israel, not a single one was faithful to God. All of them turned away. And so we have that second part to be true. Things did not go well in Samaria. For the southern kingdom, for Judah, things went a little bit better. A little bit less than half of the kings were faithful to God. Instead, all along this time, we see people turning away from God. We see false temples erected. We see idols being worshipped. We see some moments where God's people are doing really well. And we also have some of the most horrific and awful stories in the entire Bible during this period. Not only is this tragic, not only is it heartbreaking to see God's people once again be predominantly faithless, we see Israel is missing out on the entire purpose that God had assembled them as a people. The entire reason why God had given them this land, this home that was to be theirs, it wasn't merely for their sake. Through them, they were supposed to be a light to the nations. But this period of the divided kingdom is one where they just begin to look more and more like the nations. But the part of the cycle is found in this section as well. While God's people are turning away, we again see God be faithful and pursue his people. The primary way that he cares and calls back his people is through the raising up of prophets. These people that God would speak through, that he would send to the Israelites, to those in the north and those in the south, to call them back to faithfulness to God. These people who would go to the kings and remind them, if you obey God, things will go well, to call them back in leading the people to this God. Today we're going to focus on one of those prophets that I think helps us to see this period of Israel's history well. And it's a prophet named Elisha. We really need to emphasize that accent on that second part. Otherwise, we could be talking about a different guy. Elisha, not Elijah. And we read about so many things that God did through his life, but one particular story captures this period of Israel's history well. And that comes from 2 Kings chapter 5. 2 Kings 5. I encourage you, as some of you are already doing, to have this open in front of you, whether in print or in pixel. It's important to me that I don't care if you hear any of my words. I want you to see where this is coming from in God's word. So 2 Kings chapter 5. If you're having a hard time finding 2 Kings, that's all right. You have a really good table of contents up in the front that can help you find 2 Kings. But let's have the text in front of us. As we get into 2 Kings chapter 5, we're introduced to a man who's going to be the focal point of the story, and he's actually not one of God's people. He's not from the northern kingdom. He's not from the southern kingdom. He is a Gentile. He is an enemy of Israel. He's from a land called Syria, or if you have a different translation, it might say Aram. And this man, as we read about him, he sure seems to have everything figured out. Things are going incredibly well for him. He's this military leader who's had so much success to the point that he's been elevated to an advisor of the king, like a right-hand man, essentially. And as we continue, we get to read that he is obviously wealthy, so he has the position, he has the status, he has the money, he has everything. Things sure seem to be looking incredible for this man named Naaman. But as with everybody in this world who seeks to find our fulfillment from this world, we see that no amount of status or wealth or position or relationship or anything else that we might find can fulfill in the way that we long for. Maybe it's a time of introspection that we have and the tossing and turning of nights, the quietness that our brain tries to fill as we look at all that we have and think, I need more. It's not enough. I'm still lacking. I'm still longing. Or maybe it's not when we have a time of introspection, but one is forced upon us. That while we have plans and things under control, things are pointed out to us on occasion that, oh, I have less control than I thought I did. And something like that happens for Naaman when he realizes his lack as he discovers he has leprosy. Now, leprosy is a disease that's talked about all throughout the Bible, and some of the reason for that is it's a fairly broad term. Leprosy means something in our day. Leprosy meant something else in the New Testament time. And in the Old Testament, it's even a bigger bigger meaning. That leprosy was basically just a catch-all word for any sort of skin blemish. So this could be something as common as eczema, that would be diagnosed as leprosy at the time. Or it could be any number of diseases that first revealed itself through a visible skin rash or blemish. And so when someone had leprosy, it was always the question of, is this just something unsightly that's going to be uncomfortable? Or me seeing this rash, is that the beginning of the end? Now, we're not sure which one Naaman has, but it's enough to wonder, is this benign or is this the end of my life? Maybe we can relate to that in some way as ourselves or someone that we know has discovered a spot on themselves. Could be something growing that's visible or that appeared in an x-ray, in a test of some sort. And it always comes with the questions of, did we catch it in time? Is there going to be a treatment for this? Or am I about to be told how many months I have? How many weeks? For Naaman, whether it was benign or not, he knew one thing, that leprosy in its various forms was unanimously untreatable. So whether this is the end or not, he has nothing he could do to stop it. Something is out of his control. That is until the unlikely news comes from the even more unlikely source. As we said, Naaman was this military commander, so one of the things he would do is he would go out and lead raids against his enemies. And one of those enemies was Israel. And as he went out there and he led this raid, they captured plunder, and that included a little girl, who he brought back, turned into a slave, and made the servant of his wife. And when this girl hears that Naaman has leprosy, there's no dancing with joy. There's no celebration. There's no, yes, he got his. This is what he gets for taking me away from home. Instead, it's the realization that there is a God who can do the things that are impossible. There's a God who can bring treatment for all that's untreatable. There is a God who can do things that no one else can anticipate. And there is a God in Israel. This is what we read in 2 Kings 5, verse 3. It says, she, the servant girl, said to her mistress, would that my lord, would that Naaman were with the prophet that's in Samaria. He would cure him of his leprosy. Now, if there's anything that shows the desperation of Naaman is that he seizes this opportunity right at the beginning. He goes to pursue this form of a cure. I mean, he could have easily said, so what if there's a God in Samaria? I have beaten Samaria. So what if there's a prophet that's there? I've shown our superiority over them. What could he possibly do for me? No, he hears that there's a chance at a cure, and so he snaps at it. So he goes and gets permission from his king to go into Samaria to find healing. And while he does, he brings with him, the technical term is a lot of money. And I mean a lot of money, like a tremendous amount of wealth, because that's what you're supposed to do, right? If there's someone who can give him healing, if there's some God who can do this task for him, if there's some prophet that's there, well, he's going to do whatever it takes to show that he deserves this healing, to demonstrate his worthiness. Name your price. It is not a problem. I will be healed. So he goes to the king of Samaria because that's what you're supposed to do, right? If there's this powerful prophet, surely he's going to be employed by the king. That's what he'll want to be close to his God. He'll want to be close to this one who speaks on behalf of his God, or at least have the appearance of that to the people. But when he shows up to the king of Samaria, this king clearly has no expectation of God to show up. No expectation for God to work in his life. No expectation of God to be there at all. Not only is the prophet not in his employ, he is not considering the God of the Bible at all. In fact, he thinks this whole thing is a setup for him. Naaman comes with this letter for the king saying, please heal my advisor, Naaman, and he thinks it's a test. Heal Naaman, otherwise you're going to start having some problems with Syria. And so since it all falls on him, it all rests on his power, the only expectation that he has is what he could do with his might, his power, his position. He sees that this is hopeless. He cries out, what am I, God? Am I able to do this? And in his anguish, he tears his clothes. This was a Jewish practice that was common at the time. In these moments of grief or mourning or despair, that people would tear their clothes as this sign of contrition. And it actually happens all the time in this period of the divided kingdom. You hear about it a lot in those few faithful kings of the southern kingdom, where they would come to a point of realization of seeing how far gone they have become. When they see how far removed they are from their God, when they see the acts of child sacrifice and worshiping these false gods around them, and they're just, grief overwhelms them that they tear their clothes. Happens time and time again in this story. Seems like the only people who had a good experience during the reign of the kings were those in the garment industry. But as God always does, he is faithful in these times. He has raised up a man who can help this king who wants nothing to do with him. When Elisha, the prophet, hears about this, he sends a messenger to the king, which essentially just comes down to, why are you tearing your clothes, bud? Send him to me. I can help Naaman. It's such a great reminder of how God raises people up to point us back to him. Such an encouragement that as people who can get so focused in our world, what's on our schedule, what I am responsible for, to miss the brighter picture, the broader picture of what God is doing. As I said, it's one of the joys of coming out here, because I could be so focused on Thornton that I miss what that same God is doing in a great place like Erie. So we need these reminders. We need people to point us back to him. Such a great encouragement that there is no possible category of us doing the Christian life on our own, nor is there an expectation to do so. God raises people up to be part of our life, to point us back to him. So whether you're in a group or connected with other people, you have people around you, who know what it starts to look like in your life when you start to drift away from the way that God is directing you, we need those people to call us back to him. And this is a building full of people like that. Well, Elisha calls for Naaman to come out to him. And so Naaman gathers up all of his entourage that he brought, all of the wealth that he brought, all of the pomp and circumstance of someone of his position, his stature, his worthiness, his glory. And he starts to travel out to this prophet. But along the way, he stopped as a messenger comes from Elisha. And if there's one thing that's going to be true about Naaman, is he's not in the place of dealing with these messengers. He has come to see the guy. He's brought all of this to show that he is worthy of seeing the guy. He is used to being able to get an audience with people like this. I mean, people have to book his schedule. Of course, Elisha should be honored to see him. But a messenger stops him. But not just that, this messenger tells him the way that he will be cured. Go to the Jordan River and bathe yourself 7 times. That's it. You don't need a meeting. You don't need to go to his house. Just go bathe yourself in the Jordan. You'll be healed. And this is a step too far for Naaman. This is verse 11. But Naaman was angry and went away saying, behold, I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. See, Naaman had expectations of how this would go. He was used to how he was treated. He was used to what some of his position could get access to. And people do things for him. I mean, he's Naaman. So he expected this prophet to come out and make this whole big show about it, calling on the name of the Lord, doing something with his hands, waving over the place, and that would bring about the healing. This impressive work for a man as impressive as him, that's how this is supposed to work. But this healing of go and bathe yourself in the river 7 times, well, it's just ridiculous. This is not how things are supposed to go. I mean, all throughout the story, we see Naaman having set expectations of what it is he deserves. He's a man of power and status and wealth, so he deserves this healing. He is worthy of it. He's going to demonstrate his worthiness of it. He can afford it. The cost is not an issue. I can do whatever I need to get this, to show that he deserved this from as a right. All throughout the story, it feels like Naaman feels like he is not being treated as he deserves. And in that sense, he's right. This whole story is one of Naaman not being treated as he deserves. And we're clued in on that from the very first verse, this little throwaway line in there, as we hear about all of these victories that have been given to Naaman from the Lord. Naaman, this foreigner, this one who's oppressing God's people, this one who has gotten to this position because of all the victories that he's won, this person who has the wealth because he's gotten to this position, this person who has the status because all of what's been building off of his success militarily, And we're given a little clue in there of where it all comes from. God has given him all that he has. This outsider, this foreigner, this person who doesn't even know God has everything he has because God has given it to him. He has not been treated as he deserves. And he starts to head back home when he hears of how ridiculous this treatment is, when things do not go the way that he expected. But he's stopped by these servants that he had brought with him. Verse 13 says, but his servants came near and said to him, my father, it is a great word the prophet has spoken to you. Will you not do it? As he actually said to you, wash and be clean. This is a really difficult verse to translate. And if you have a different translation in front of you, it might read a little bit differently. It's just off of memory. It says something along the lines of, this prophet, or you would have been willing to do any feat to get this healing. And this prophet has just asked for you to wash yourself. Has he just said, wash and be clean? Why are you less willing to do what is easier when you were willing to do what was more difficult? See, again, all of it was thought about from this idea of worthiness. I will demonstrate that I deserve to be healed. You ask any feat of me, I will do it. Any task, nothing's too great. I will prove to you that I am worthy, that I deserve to be healed in this way. You want me to slay a dragon? I'll do it. You want me to climb up to a remote mountain to find a rare flower and that's going to be used in my treatment? You want me to travel to Dagobah and fight some version of Darth Vader and it ends up being this journey of self-discovery? Whatever the task is, I will do it. I will prove that I deserve this. And the servant said to him, you're willing to do these hard things. So why not do this easier thing to wash and be cleaned? So he goes to the Jordan River with this assembly and he dunks himself, bathes himself 1, 2, 3 times. Has everyone there watching him? It's got to be really uncomfortable. 4, 5, 6. I mean, this is ridiculous. This isn't going to work. 7th time. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child. And he was clean. Naaman did not get what he deserved this day. He had set expectations of what this was going to look like. And this task to go and bathe himself in the Jordan River 7 times, that's ridiculous. And it is ridiculous. That's the point. I mean, he even says earlier, like, we have better waters back home. And yeah, I've been to the Jordan. I don't doubt it. But also, many people would have been bathing in this water. But there were lepers in Israel. See, the point was not the water. The point was not Naaman's worthiness. The point was not even that Elijah had sent word that this was going to work. The point was to see that there is a God who does not treat people as they deserve. And when Naaman came out of the water that 7th time, he knew exactly that. Because he travels back to see Elijah. I say back to, he never saw him the first time. He travels to see Elijah for the first time. And as he does so, he doesn't come up to him and say, you did it, I'm healed. He doesn't push his sleeve back and see the spot's gone. He doesn't exclaim about how incredible it is. But the one thing that we know about Naaman, the one thing that's been clear about him throughout this entire story is he will stop at no length to be healed. That is his one and only focus in the story. That his entire journey into enemy territory is so he could be healed. The entire walking of this entourage, bringing all of his wealth, bringing all of this pomp and circumstance throughout this area with him, traveling constantly to go to all these places is because he's going to whatever length to show I am worthy of being healed. But when he is finally healed, he says nothing about it. Doesn't bring it up once. Instead, he notices something greater. This is verse 15. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and he came and stood before him and he said, behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So accept now a present from your servant. And he said, this is Elisha said, as the Lord lives and before whom I stand, I will receive one. I want you to still know, this is not something you could buy. This is not something that you could prove you deserved. It is a free gift given. He urged him to take it, but he refused. See, Naaman comes into enemy territory looking for a healing. But as he does so, he discovers something even greater. And why is that? Because this was a man who was used to getting what he was expected, used to getting what he thought he deserved. And yet, as he gets this healing that he had nothing to contribute to, nothing to earn, nothing to deserve, nothing to make happen, that makes no sense, is completely illogical. When he receives a healing like that, he knows for certain that it's because there's a God who doesn't treat people as they deserve. There's a God who did all this work. And that is why he comes proclaiming in that God, comes boasting in him rather than himself. he puts his trust in him that day. As we read on in the story, it turns out that's going to come at a cost. Part of his job is helping his king worship these false gods and says, I don't know how I'm going to do this while having this part of my job, but he's seeking to be faithful despite knowing the obstacles, but despite knowing that this is going to be hard. Naaman's life is transformed, not merely on the outside that day, but on the inside as well. See, we started this morning by talking about how this was a time of Israel's life that they were meant to be a light to the nations. God put them in this land. God gave them everything so that way they can point their neighbors back to the one true God. And what we actually see, despite Israel's faithlessness, that God does exactly that. He makes himself known to the nations, but not through the faithfulness of his people, despite it. All throughout the story, we see God not treating people as they deserve. We pointed this out in the life of Naaman. This was a man who was proud. This was a man who was boastful. This was a man who was an enemy of God and God's people, and yet God showed him mercy this day. But Israel as well is shown mercy throughout this story. That we see that with this king who had no expectation of God to show up. We thought this pain was his own, that he was unable to do it, so it all rested on him, all rested on his power. God raised up a prophet like he did constantly in this period to point people back to him. In fact, that more than anything else is what defines this period for the Israelites. God does not treat them as they deserve. As they constantly rebel against him, as they constantly cry out to God when things get hard, God continued to be faithful. In fact, just a few chapters after the story of Naaman, in chapter 8, we have this repeated phrase, this verse that shows up time and time again or with the exact wording or something similar to it to speak of how God is not treating his people as they deserve. 2 Kings 8:19 says, "Yet the Lord was not willing to destroy Judah for the sake of David his servant, since he promised to give a lamp to him and to his sons forever," a path, a future, a guidance that he was leading them down. See, despite Israel and Judah constantly turning away from God, it'd be easy to think, well, God's just going to cut them off. God's just going to go down plan B. God's just going to do something else. They are not deserving of his faithfulness because they continue to rebel. But God had made promises to his people, so he will keep them even if they will not. God made promises to protect and guide his people, so he will do that even as they turn towards other things and other gods as a place of fulfillment. God promised to be merciful, so he continues to do that even though what Israel deserves is to be cut off. I mean, even as we get to the end of this period, this divided kingdom, the way that it ends is both nations going into exile. It feels like, all right, finally they got what they deserved. But no, over and over again, God says, I've not left you, I've not forsaken you, I am with you, I am bringing you back. God does not treat them as they deserve. As we look at the story in this Old Testament to understand what God is doing now, that I think is the most clear piece. God still does not treat people as they deserve. We might be getting tired of that cycle that's over and over again in the Old Testament. Faithfulness, to turning towards others, to crying out, to God rescuing, to things going well, and then repeating it over and over again. Feels like it's just the same story time and time again. Sometimes it's judges, sometimes it's kings, sometimes it's prophets, but it's just always this endless cycle. But maybe one of the reasons why we are tired of it is we haven't had that time of introspection, of looking into our life. Because what I see in mine, well, it kind of goes like this. God is faithful. I turn away from him. I cry out to him, God, why have you left me? And he remains faithful as always. Things go well. And then the cycle seems to continue over and over again. As I look at my life, it looks a lot like the life of the Israelites in the Old Testament. Might just be me, but I have an inkling that it's not. God's people continue to turn away from him, and God continues to be faithful to his people. God continues to be merciful. It is a good thing that he does not treat us as we deserve. See, if we get to a place in our life where we look at all that we might have, all that we possess, all the relationships, all the status, all the money that we might have, whatever that might be that we hold on to as our source, as our identifier, as what it is that gives us value in life, that we strive for, there comes a point when we look at it and say, it's not enough. I still need more. I need more and more. Or maybe it's a point where you recognize the spots that's in our life to see that what I've been building towards will fail, to see that I have less control than I thought I did. I have less time than I thought I did. As we look at the spots that point to the longing for more, it helps us to see this is not enough. We, like Naaman, look into our life and have this prompting for something greater than it. And in fact, as we look at the way Naaman was saved, it makes me think of the way that we have been saved. As he was rescued from his spot, we see how God rescues us from more than was just a spot. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, "For our sake, he, God, made Jesus to be sin, made Jesus to be considered as if he sinned, as if he had done all that we had done, if he was the one on this endless cycle rather than us. Made Jesus to be counted as if he was sin, despite the fact he knew no sin. He was perfect in every way. He was flawless, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." See, God here treats Jesus as he does not deserve. Jesus, who is perfect in every way, is considered as if he is us. He is treated as responsible for our sins. He takes that from us as he is faithful all the way to the cross, pursues us by coming to this world and dying a death that he did not deserve so that he can remove this spot, remove this blemish, take this away from us. But that's not where it ends. It's not as though he gives us a fresh slate, a new start, like, all right, let's see how they do. Time two, second chance. Because we know how the cycle goes. We know how it will go if we are left to our own devices again. So it's not as though he takes what is from us, but gives us, it says, the righteousness of God. Gives us his perfection. Counts it as though we were the faithful ones and not on this ever-ending roller coaster. This is the ultimate picture of not being treated as we deserved, as God himself comes into this world to pay this price that we could not possibly do. The saving that does not come because of our status, that has nothing to do with our position to move God to act, that there's no great deed or feat that we have to do because the greatest of deeds has already been done for us. And the saving of Naaman that comes at such an easier place. You were willing to do the more difficult things. Why not do this easier thing? Well, our saving is even easier than this, as there's even less that we have to do. There's no dunking ourselves in the river. There's no traveling that we need to do. There's no voyage that we need to take. There's no worthiness we need to demonstrate because the word of Jesus, you and I have already been made clean. We've been washed, made whole, complete, perfectly without blemish. None of us have gotten this from what we could have produced or earned, but we have a God who looks down on us and sees our spots, our lack, our longing, our failures, our insecurities, and does not treat us as we deserve. Let me pray for us. Father, it's a joy to be here on the Erie campus and get to do the greatest thing that we possibly can, which is open your word. You're a God who does not leave us or forsake us. That as we read these stories of the Old Testament, we are not doing archaeology to discover something that happened, but we are seeing a story that continues today. A story that you are continuing to work and write in the very lives of the people in this room. And it's a story that is overwhelmingly marked by not treating us as we deserve. We are people who are far off, so you pursued us. We have people who have turned away, so you have made repentance possible. We have people who have longed for other things in life only to realize that nothing else satisfies, and that's because we were meant to be with you. And so you give us the greatest thing that there is, which is yourself. You come to this world, you take away our imperfection and gives us perfection, making us your righteousness, making us clean without blemish, all because you are a God who does not treat us as we deserve. So it's you and you alone we pray. Amen.